The Tom Woods Show, episode 2388.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here, and I'm delighted to welcome you to yet another episode of The Tom Woods Show, episode 2388, with Cary Gress, who is a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. We're going to be talking about her book, The End of Woman. I've got it right here. See, now that I have video, I can actually, let's see, where's the camera? Hold it up. The End of Woman, How Smashing the Patriarchy Has Destroyed Us. You have a PhD in, what is it?
In philosophy, actually.
Oh, wow. And is it from Catholic U?
Yeah, that's where I got it.
Mm-hmm. I bet that was pretty rigorous.
Oh man, you don't know the half of it. Yeah, it was made all the more rigorous too because I was having children while I was doing it. So it was just crazy things like the elevators don't work and I had an infant with me and you know, you can't get books from the stacks with a baby. Anyway,
oh gosh, so, get out of here.
Intense, yeah.
Well, obviously we have a very provocative book here to talk about, but can you just, I'm always curious when I talk to people with PhDs, what did you do your dissertation on? Do you mind if I just ask that?
Yeah, well, I actually almost did two. I started one and then my director moved to universities and I wasn't deep enough in. I'd been learning Polish actually because I was initially going to write on Karol Wojtyła. And anyway, my advisor left and so I had to start over and I just decided to go with something that the languages I already had under my belt. So
yeah.
I wrote on Alistair MacIntyre and Jacques Maritain on human rights actually.
Oh, they're both really, really interesting people. So that's, and by the way, my college roommate was Polish and he told me Polish is an extremely difficult language. There are only about 40 million of us. We'll learn English. You know, you don't put yourself through it, was what he told me. So.
Yeah, no, I think that's very good wisdom. In fact, that was the funny thing about learning it is nobody really knew how to teach it because they just don't have the experience with it. And just the humor it was to hear this American accent in Polish because they don't have, like we hear all kinds of people learning English all the time. We know their accents. They just had no kind of experience of that other than small children. So it was very humbling to be learning.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk about your book. And what we might do, and I haven't even asked your permission for this, so I'm kind of crossing my fingers on this, that maybe I might have you on twice because I feel like there are two parts to this, even though I know you've kind of divided into four.
Right.
One part would be going through some of the thinkers, setting the stage for where we are today, and then looking at the practical results of where we are today. And so, and I think that's where people want to immediately jump to. But I think it's important to start with the foundations. And in particular, I think it's very interesting that you have focused on people in the development, the history of the development of feminism, whose names are familiar to most educated people, and yet whose names, I think, and whose careers and lives and thought most people think they know, but they may not know. And in fact, like the quote-unquote conservative movement, if we can say that with a straight face, will very often point to these very women and say, we need to go back to these people. And they're always doing this. It's always, we need to go back to people from 30 years ago who were 5% better than you people are now, and we'll start there. They never want to start before the whole revolution began.
Yeah.
So let's start with, first of all, when somebody talks about feminism, I mean, that could mean a lot of things to a lot of people. I think some people hear the word feminism and they respond very negatively because they think of it as an anti-man ideology that's economically irrational, socially irrational, and fueled by hatred. But I think there are other people who look at it and just think, well, it just means that women shouldn't have to have boring existences, washing dishes at home, and that when we watch old movies and we see women treated contemptuously often by men, we assume that was going on in society in general, and we just want women to be treated with dignity and respect. And they think that's what it is. So what is it really?
Yeah. No, I think that's a huge question. And one of the issues I have with the word feminism is each person has their own understanding of what they think it means. It's sort of this empty suit of a word that we sort of fill up with our own categories so frequently. So that was what was super interesting about doing all of this research and going back to the very beginning, because I was able to get a new sense of sort of this congealed, what really at the core has feminism been, and to sort of see these continuous ideas, which I'll enumerate in a minute, kind of rolling through the culture and just almost like a snowball, just getting bigger and bigger and bigger as we go along. So I think people will be able to identify with these. But what I found really the overarching idea was you have all these women, 1790s, 1780s and there on, and women have got really hard lives because we've got a lot of children. A lot of them die bearing children. A lot of the children die. This is just a really incredibly tough time to be a woman. Historically, it's always been a tough time to be a woman. But I think that they were trying to figure out, how do we help women, very sincerely and really wanted to be a help. But how they answered the question is where things got off on the wrong foot. They answered the question by saying, let's help women become more like men. And that's the beginning of all the wrong direction in which the movement has gone. You also have all of these ideological threads and trends sort of picking up. I mean, Mary Wollstonecraft, she's considered the godmother of the movement, very much was involved with egalitarianism, which of course then rolls into socialism and into communism. So that thread was there from the very beginning. What I eventually call this concept of smashing the patriarchy, that started from almost the very beginning. The next thread that gets picked up is the occult, gets added to it. And of course, we can see that in spades in our own time, how much the occult and witchcraft is very alive in the feminist movement. And then the third piece is the concept of free love and getting rid of monogamy, getting rid of the nuclear family, trying to allow women to have sexual relations without consequences the way they perceive that men do. So those are really the kind of key elements that I think we can sort of consistently see throughout the 1800s. And then they just get on steroids with the new left and the second wave and up to what we're seeing today. But yeah, you're exactly right. It's incredibly challenging to sort of pin it down and figure out what people mean by it, especially because a lot of people have sort of this general sense of it just means to be pro-woman. So if you're not really, you don't embrace feminism, you must not be pro-woman kind of concept. So anyway, that's why it was just great to go back to the beginning and sort of figure out, like, at its core, what's happening with this movement.
I think these days, a word like fascism is just used as a catch-all term of abuse used to attack your political enemies. And I'm wondering, does the term patriarchy serve the same purpose, or does it have a more precise meaning for them?
Yeah. Well, it started out with something more precise. It came from Mary Wollstonecraft. She's writing along with Thomas Paine, trying to sort of justify what's happened in the French Revolution. Of course, she saw the bloodiness of it and whatnot, but she firmly believed that a lot of these problems that society, and particularly women, are having could be eradicated if you get rid of things like monarchy and any kind of hierarchy in the church or in the military. All of these things needed to sort of be collapsed down into something much more egalitarian. So that's where it started. And then, of course, the word patriarchy, the first person to really coin it in a negative way was Engels. He wrote something after Marx died about the family. And that's when he uses the term patriarchy in a negative, talking about landowners and the paterfamilias and all of this kind of concept. He's trying to say this is a bad thing. And that's really where gets picked up and run with by all those who are feminists and also communists, that two really overlap probably from about the 1930s on. So yeah, I think you're right. It's become very much just a vague concept that people just sort of think it's anything I'm sort of disagreeing with. And I'm discovering this more as I'm talking with people about the book. You know, you think, well, of course they mean like the head of the household and they mean all the scriptural elements. But a lot of people just think, well, it's toxic masculinity or whatever. They kind of plug into it whatever concepts they want. And so I think that's a really another amazing facet that has made feminism so flexible, is its capacity to sort of work in ways that it might and certainly wasn't intentionally meant to mean. And people just kind of put their own meaning with it.
Well, it's been quite some time since I picked up a copy of A Vindication of the Rights of Woman by Mary Wollstonecraft, but I did read it in college.
Yes.
And so now most of my knowledge of it now comes from your book, refreshing my memory. But one thing that I recall from the time, and maybe I'm misremembering this because it's been so long, but at the end, it's like she takes the edge off a little bit by saying that if women are allowed to be educated and to realize their potential, then this will make them more suitable companions for men, putting men back front and center at the end of the book. If my memory serves, then she ends on a somewhat conservative note, but you're arguing that over the course of the book, it's not really a conservative presentation.
Yeah, I mean, she's a really interesting character. I think this is one of the problems with the book, is that it's very emotive. And actually, that's one of the things that her own husband, William Godwin, was critical of about her in the book, was like, there's not a structure to it, especially if anyone's been trained any philosophically at all. It just feels like a big mess. You know, it's like the kitchen sink kind of thing. Like, and you feel like, didn't I just read this in the last chapter? I mean, there's a lot of repetition, and it's just a very hard book to pin down. So that I think that there are places where she generally does make these kinds of concessions, but it's just very hard to pick out from all of the other stuff. And so that's one of the real challenges. And so I don't actually pin upon her the real heart of the feminist movement in terms of its core, because she was sort of a spark for it. But I think the real core came from her son-in-law, Percy Shelley, whom she never met, but she certainly influenced because he knew her work. He knew her husband, William Godwin's work, and he was very much an free love anarchist, totally against marriage, even though he and Mary Wollstonecraft married when Mary got pregnant. So yeah, I think there are things you could generally say about Mary Wollstonecraft that I don't want to vilify her 100%. But again, she's a spark. And the real vilification actually comes from the work of Percy Shelley, who I think created the movement, ironically, as a man, and added all these three pieces together in the way that we now understand them together. So I think he's the one.
Well, we've got, as characters in your story, William Godwin, Percy Shelley, and Mary Shelley.
Right.
And they all have roles to play in this. And they all have ideas that I think are not particularly well known to the general public. If we know anything about these people, it's because of their literary works.
Yeah.
And even with their literary works, we might not really grasp exactly what they're driving at.
Yeah, I think that's right. And Percy Shelley, you know, I think people just think of him as this sort of bucolic, romantic poet and don't really realize just that in his 29 years, how influential he was. And he probably didn't realize it either. I mean, this is a man who wanted to push every taboo, kind of like he's writing at the same time that the Marquis de Sade, or writing after actually, the Marquis de Sade is writing, and he's all about pushing taboos. And he's very good friends with Lord Byron, who's also a mess. I mean, these are dastardly men. They're awful men. Shelley's got this whole trail of dead women from suicide, ex-wives, children who died, children that he fathered that he wasn't involved with. I mean, it's just horrendous when you really read a biography about him, what this man was doing. And so this was the real fruit of it, was this women's revolution that he called it. He's the one that put all of these pieces together in a way that had this dramatic effect. Because while his wife is Mary Shelley's creating Frankenstein and Frankenstein's creature, he's writing about this woman named Sithna, who was the very first independent woman who was completely, she didn't have a husband or children. Her only relationship was really with the devil. And she really captured the imagination of a lot of the women who later would call themselves feminists as, this is the kind of woman that we want to be, because there's no fertility there. There's all kinds of freedom they imagine. And it's really this radical idea of breaking taboos. And that's really what that whole romantic period was focused on, was how do we tear down these taboos?
The romantics are interesting because there's a part of them, though, that is very drawn to things that are far away and that they could be far away distance-wise. Now, Diderot was not a romantic, but he very much, I think he's in some ways in that tradition because he theorized about what people in Tahiti, what their intimate relations were like. And he developed this wild theory that they all believed in free love when that was not in fact the case. But he wants it to be true. You get that sense. But things that are old, like there was at least a current within the Romantic movement that was very interested in the Middle Ages because it was very distant and remote from us and very strange to our sensibilities. So they have some of that, but not the whole package.
Not the whole package. And, you know, there's also this fascination with the Greeks, I think, too, where that comes in as far as a Greek ethos and morality that's not connected with the Old Testament too, and the
right.
Ten Commandments, that also is very much ushered in to their work, is this idea of how do we establish something that's virtuous, but without using anything connected with Christianity and or even Judaism. So,
yeah. And by the way, starting with the Renaissance and forward, there was an attempt to portray the Greeks as if they were an entirely religionless society. And
wow.
They just walked around occupied entirely by reason. If you actually study what Greek religion was like, it was part of everyday life.
Wow.
The head of the household was the head of the cult of that home. They had to make it into like the little Enlightenment society that they wanted to live in. But so they have to force everybody into that mold and then make the rest of us pretend that's how they really were.
No, I think that's a huge insight because that's exactly what's happened, this sort of a-religious, just untethered from anything, except they think it's tethered to reason. But of course, we know that reason just alone doesn't have the inner structure to lead to a moral society. I mean, look at how much things have changed in the last 15 years alone. There's just not enough grounding in that once you take something like the Ten Commandments away. So you're right.
Let's move to the United States now and talk about a couple of names that will be familiar to most people, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony. Now, again, it's not uncommon to hear people who are talking about feminism contrast modern feminism unfavorably with what was taught by Susan B. Anthony or Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Do you think that's a legitimate tack to take?
Yeah, no, I think it's an interesting one. I mean, this is what I thought myself until I really started looking into this. I hadn't studied first wave feminism. I'd only studied second wave feminism for a book that I wrote.
And would you mind distinguishing between those?
Okay, so first wave really goes up until I would say Betty Friedan sort of kicks off second wave feminism. First wave is really the suffrage movement and the early stages of women's rights. And then the second wave starts with Betty Friedan, where you really see this connection with the new left, and it takes on just kind of totally radical overtones that are related to gender equality or gender erasure and really changing the culture altogether, which we can talk about later. But I think that's probably the best place to make the break. So I went back to Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony thinking, you know, I'm just going to find this lovely women who are just for suffrage and maybe some nice writings about women and all of that. And I was totally unprepared for what I found because, you know, I think most of us just aren't really that interested in reading what feminists have written. I mean, I think that's part of the problem is a lot of it's really dry, you know, like Judith Butler's kind of work is just impenetrable. But a lot of it is just kind of boring. But yeah, I went back to Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, whom I would group together because they really branded themselves as sort of this team of, they were the ones that kicked off the women's movement. And despite the fact that they didn't actually know each other until after the Seneca Falls meeting had happened, this is where Elizabeth Cady Stanton had sort of put her stake in the ground and sort of said, move forward with the suffrage movement. But they didn't even know each other at that point. And Cady Stanton actually went and wrote Susan B. Anthony back into the story so that it would be sort of this whole story of these are the founders. But Susan B. Anthony was also very much a mouthpiece for Cady Stanton. So I think a lot of the ideas came from Cady Stanton. We also know that one of Susan B. Anthony's biographers spent 4 days burning all of her papers, all of her letters, all of her correspondence, all of her journals, all these kinds of things, speeches. So we don't know as much about her as we do Elizabeth Cady Stanton. But yeah, I think the important piece to start with is just the recognition that this is happening. Seneca Falls and the time in which they're living, we tend to think it is sort of this puritanical, Victorian, prim and proper sensibility. And yet, this is much more like the Wild West. I mean, it's really a mess. You've got most of their work was done after the Civil War. And they're very much, this revival's going on, but it has all kinds of mediums and seances and contacting the dead. In a lot of ways, it kind of mimicked what was happening technologically. You have these phone poles going up, but people being able to connect with, I guess they're telegraphs at that point, but people being able to connect in long distances. And so they just sort of saw this as this spiritual element. And so many people had died in the war. So many children were dying in early stages that this was really appealing to people to get some kind of solace by contacting the spirits. So this is where Elizabeth Cady Stanton got the idea for the Seneca Falls was at what's called the Spirit Table. It's now at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. But this is the rappings that were going on in New York State. These demonic rappings were kind of answering questions, I guess sort of akin to like a Ouija board or something where you're getting answers in some bizarre esoteric way. But this is what these tables were doing in New York City. And so she gets this idea for Seneca Falls, and that's really where the movement starts. And ultimately, she started out as a Calvinist and she abandoned her Christian faith and actually worked to try and get rid of it. She was really focused on this new spiritualism that was obviously connected with the seances. She wrote this book called The Women's Bible, which was very anti-Christian, kooky. Like it feels like a, you know, angry teenager wrote it in many respects. It feels very juvenile. So that certainly lost her a lot of the followers. But she actually finally got kicked out of her own organization when there was this huge scandal that erupted with a woman named Victoria Woodhull, who was dubbed Mrs. Satan because she was very much a medium in New York State. She actually ran for president. She was very much a promoter of free love and the occult. And so Elizabeth and Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony decided to have her speak at one of their events. And, you know, it was just a huge tactical error because they ended up not only alienating most of their audience. But there was also the other women's suffrage group that ended up getting embroiled in it because of the scandal that was created. And anyway, it's a very long story. It's in the book. But it was this scandal that really brought them down and delayed suffrage for like 30 years because of the fact that there was so much infighting and so much drama and all of these other tentacles that were related to the movement that really had nothing to, theoretically could have, the movement could have done much better if Katie Stanton wasn't involved in all these esoteric things and the free love movement for sure. But that was really what, how, when if you look at the span of their work, it was really marked by those things. Although now we just hear sort of the polish of their focus on suffrage. So it's quite the juxtaposition when you start looking into the details of what these women are up to versus what we think they were doing.
Yeah, this spiritualism stuff I was not aware of until I read your book. And all I could think of course, this was much later, was Harry Houdini in the 1920s, spending so much of his time going around debunking these people. You know, that you're taking advantage, because I understand, as you say, why people would want to communicate with the dead. They've just lived through this period of unimaginable loss, and he lost his own mother, and he felt like, yeah, what actually they're doing is they're taking advantage of people who have had a tremendous loss. But alas, he was too late to be around quite at that time. But this woman's Bible thing was also a surprise to me. It makes me want to flip through and see what she was up to in it. But the sorts of things that, though, that get brought up today when people want to cite Stanton and Anthony as exemplars of the real kind of feminism, authentic feminism, is that you can find statements they made expressing horror at abortion.
Right. Yeah.
And as far as you know, is that sincere?
You know, I think it was sincere. I think that Elizabeth Cady Stanton really loved being a mother, especially in the earlier years. And then it was later she sort of soured on it. And but I think that they were very sincere in it, but partially because it's just still somewhat unconscionable. But there was a place to get abortions in New York City. I mean, brothels were rampant. I think it was probably just the era in which they lived that.
Yeah, everybody, more or less. I mean, there was a societal consensus that doesn't exist today.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. But yeah, to make her out as this exemplar, is when you start seeing the underbelly, it's really clear that there was some major issues there.
Hey, everybody, let me tell you about the upcoming Expat Money Summit, hosted by Expat Money Show host Mikkel Thorup and two-time Tom Woods Show guest. Mikkel has lived everywhere, visited everywhere. He knows everything there is to know about international relocation and a whole bunch of issues short of international relocation, like second passports or banking offshore or whatever it is you're interested in regarding the expat lifestyle. And this whole event, which, by the way, features me as a speaker, is free. It's taking place October 2nd through the 6th online. You can check it out at expatmoneysummit.com. It is the largest offshore event in the world, and confirmed speakers include Ron Paul, Doug Casey, Mark Faber, Jim Rogers, me, also international lawyers, offshore precious metals dealers, foreign real estate experts, and much, much more. So we're going to be talking about finding a safe place to live in the world, legally eliminating your tax bill so you're not funding war, international wealth protection, second passports, offshore banking, and much more. So check it out by getting your free ticket at expatmoneysummit.com. That's expatmoneysummit.com. All right, so we're talking about people who were focused on the issue of suffrage, and obviously you can understand why somebody who holds feminist views would favor extending the suffrage to women. But do they also think that women's suffrage would have social benefits as well, would benefit society, and if so, how?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question. I think that what they were seeing was a lot of women who were losing custody of their children. If there was a divorce, you know, there are all kinds of issues that they just felt like if women had a voice in, then they could rectify these things and women's lives wouldn't be so hard. So I think that was certainly behind the best of intentions. And so that was really the force for it. And you can't fault that. That's laudable in the sense that that's what they really were pushing for and focused on. But it got mucky and ugly when they started including the esoteric and the occult and all of these other elements into it and really undermining their own effort.
What is the role exactly that the occult plays in all this? I mean, it's so surprising and odd that I'm afraid people will hear this and roll their eyes, but this is a real thing.
Yeah.
And so what is their attraction? Is it simply that it's not Christianity? There are a lot of things that aren't Christianity. Why not Buddhism?
I mean, it's really interesting. A lot of the ideas came from this woman named Madame Blavatsky, who was this Russian noblewoman who apparently left Russia and just traveled all over the world and picked up all these different religions and sort of cobbled them together in this religion called Theosophy. And actually, Gloria Steinem's mother was a practitioner of Theosophy. I don't even know how you practice it, but she apparently was very much involved in it, Gloria Steinem reported later, obviously much later in years. So you can see kind of this cyclical thing going on. But the attraction to it was that you didn't need male clergy either. It was women at home at the table that they became these sort of spiritual priestesses who are in charge of everything, who are calling the shots, who are focused on the direction in which the spiritual world is going. And it doesn't have anything to do with a church or church building. It's sort of inverting that order of what Christianity looked like at that stage. So that's one of the reasons why it was so important. And it, you know, it was also about power too. And Victoria Woodhull, this Mrs. Satan woman, their family was always moving because her father was like this complete snake oil salesman who was wanted in all these different states. But he had been prostituting his daughters and both sexually and then using them as mediums since they were young, young girls. The fact that these two girls who never even had like indoor bathrooms, I mean, they talked about the family going to the bathroom out in the yard, you know, it's just nightmare scenarios of children growing up at that time, that Victoria had the wherewithal to be able to run for president because she had this brokerage firm that one of the Rothschilds helped her with because she had done seances for him and told him which stocks to pick. So he was like, you and your sister need your own. So there was this element of power and control that was also incredibly attractive. And this is what was really where the platform came from, was by speaking through the spirits and listening to what the spirits told them to gain power and prestige in the civilization or in the culture, I should say.
All right. I'd like to take what remaining time we have and push forward into the second wave a little bit. And then if I could persuade you to do so, maybe you could come back and then we can talk about, let's look at by various metrics, how this has all turned out or how it evolved over time. Because I am quite sure that there are some manifestations of feminism today that Susan B. Anthony did not anticipate. So we would have ample time to talk about that too. But let's talk about Betty Friedan, because again, I learned in your book more about her than I ever knew. I read The Feminine Mystique, again, in college. I'm very familiar with the arguments in there. But some of her biographical details, I think, shed further light into what she was up to in that book. So maybe you could share some of those with us.
Yeah. So she was probably one of the most shocking people that I researched after, of course, the two we've just been speaking of. But there's a book by a man named Daniel Horowitz, who was a friend of Friedan's. And he noticed at some point, I think she was a visiting professor at USC, and he noticed that she was using like Saul Alinsky tactics with her students. And he thought, okay, this isn't just your average housewife. Like this woman has been trained by Marxists somewhere. And so he did some digging into her life. And finally he asked her, I want to do this book on you and talk about your communist roots, because I think this will be a good thing because people will be able to see that someone who was a communist was able to navigate around McCarthy and still be able to promote Marxist ideas. So he was really a proponent of like saying, see, this is, you know, all this stuff that she did was great. So it was fantastic for me because I could just use so much of his work. Well, of course, Friedan said, no way, I will never let you see my private papers, which of course are private, I think, until 2035. So he just used open source resources and other things that he had access to, cobble together this book that's just really remarkable, but very much chronicling her communist path. Very much, she was very involved with communism, even as a college student, and deeply interested in the question about women.
What is the name of his book?
It's called something like The Making of the Feminine Mystique by Betty Friedan or something.
Okay. So yeah, I can look it up with Horowitz is the name. Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, I was also able to cobble together some of the things that he wrote and some of the things that Betty wrote with this woman named Bella Dodd, who was also a communist that finally left the Communist Party. Archbishop Fulton Sheen helped her leave the Communist Party and she later became a Catholic. And so—
Yeah, Paul Kenger at Grove City College just wrote a book on her. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it was really interesting to sort of weave together these pieces and see, you know, what was this woman up to? And her big motivator was, of course, she was an adherent of Stalin's. She hated Hitler. Her focus was really to get women out of the home. She has in her journal something, a quote from Engels about how women will only be free when they are doing productive work outside the home. So that's her goal. It's also, I don't think she realized it, but this is also that same concept Hitler has at Auschwitz, you know, Arbeit macht frei, work will make you free. So she's dug into this wholeheartedly. But what's fascinating about her is that she doesn't come at it the typical way most philosophers would. She's coming at it from psychological perspective, and she uses that perspective to really manipulate women, I think, into believing that that's really would set them free. And I'm sure she believed it wholeheartedly. So she wasn't being disingenuous, but what she was using psychology, and especially that concept of victimhood that I think women are particularly susceptible to, and fear of missing out, which we see even in Eve, to convince women to get out of the home. She uses this crazy language that I'm sure you remember, the comfortable concentration camp, to talk about home. And it's pretty galling to see that she can get away with a term like that when she's basically talking to the most privileged women in almost all of human history as she's writing this, because of just the technological advances and the financial windfall that's happening in the 60s, the post-World War II effort, all of that that's going on as America's middle class is rising and whatnot.
Well, and not to mention, I think Alexander Solzhenitsyn might have something to say about what life in a camp is actually like.
Yeah. Well, and anybody that's been to any of the camps in Europe either. So that's the amazing thing, is what those people Auschwitz would have given to live in these comfortable concentration camps. So yeah, it's pretty amazing that she was so effective. And, you know, she sold 3 million copies in the first several years. So she's affected everybody. And I think that one of the things that she really did was allow women to sort of divorce themselves from children and husband and home in a way that I think was really brand new, because that, and that's really what led to probably much more easily to the abortion issue, because these things were suddenly seen as obstacles to women's happiness instead of means through which women can achieve happiness. So I think that that's really, you know, if you're going to talk about some sort of Copernican turn in the movement, that's really where it took place.
Now, you will hear, maybe not so much these days, but maybe like 10, 15 years ago, you'd hear the odd feminist saying something like, we're not saying that a woman can't stay home if she wants to, as long as that's her free choice. Mm-hmm. We're just saying that women ought to have, you know, we've all heard this, right? They ought to have a broad array of choices available to them. But it's not clear that that really was the feminist position as it began to come out in this second wave. You do hear very prominent feminist voices saying, we really don't want to leave this choice in their hands because too many of them are going to choose the wrong choice. They're too, you know, they didn't put it this way, but if they're choosing the wrong choice, they can't be that bright.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a remarkable thing. I mean, that's a great Simone de Beauvoir quote was, you know, if we give women the choice, they will not leave the home. So that's where Friedan enters in, is like, let me take care of this. And so she makes it appealing and attractive to leave the home. And then, of course, things like Cosmopolitan magazine, creating the Cosmo Girl, which we now know is very fabricated woman. The Cosmo Girl could be anything but married and a mother, I think. She couldn't be a mother or a virgin. Those were the two things that she could not be, what their writers have said later. So yeah, I think it's incredible to see that claim that you can be home if you want, but there is that implication that you're not very bright. In fact, I think it's also amazing too that feminists have defined their position, but they've also been hugely successful in defining what they think the opposition looks like, and absolutely making us look like we're doormats, we're uneducated, you know, we're stupid, that we just don't know any better. And so that's why we're choosing not to be feminists. So their propaganda has just been remarkably effective. And I think that's a hard part, is that most women, I feel like I'm either one or the other, and they don't know how to sort of break out of those kind of binary options, because we just don't really see a third option very, very readily.
Well, let me ask you, Carrie Gress, a personal question then, or not a personal question, but about your personal opinion. Let's suppose you lived at the time of Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony. Now, it could well be that the feminist diagnosis of what ails women in those days is misplaced and wrong in some particulars. But on the other hand, as I say, I mean, not that this is the exhaustive explanation, but I've watched a lot of old movies, and I mean like 1930s. Mm-hmm. Now, just the other night, I was watching a gangster movie from the 1930s. And there is scene after scene where the women are just treated with absolute contempt. And not just because it's a gangster. The gangster gets called out to go somewhere. He just leaves without a word to the woman. Just walks right out. He would never treat a man this way.
Right.
So you get the sense they wouldn't put that in the movies if there weren't at least some truth to it. So it seems that it's entirely possible that there were aspects of the way women were treated that were highly undesirable. Mm-hmm. So what would you personally have advocated, how would you have approached that question differently from how the women you more or less criticize in this book approached it?
Yeah. Well, I think that's the pattern that I saw emerging was that the women in this book keep pushing for more liberal, more amoral moves away, again, away from the Ten Commandments and also really glorifying the masculine, idolizing the masculine. And that's the direction that we went. So I mean, obviously not knowing exactly how I would think back at that stage, but having researched all of this, I think the bigger question needs to be, how do we help women as women? How do we help make them better wives? How do we help our sons become better husbands? You know, those kinds of questions, instead of saying, well, we'll just get rid of fertility. We'll just get rid of the family. We'll just get rid of the nuclear family. I think that's the direction in which they were always pushing. And I think that's really where the problems happen and why it is so susceptible to Marxism, because of the fact that it links up with Marxism. The goals really ended up becoming the same kind of goal, which is fundamentally the destruction of society for sort of this revolutionary utopia.
And of course, one of the things you want to look for in a social movement is, do the people you are allegedly trying to help report spontaneously that they are in better shape now than they were, let's say, 30 years earlier or earlier on in your movement?
Right.
Has the progress of your movement made them happier or less happy? And you in your book share some of this happiness kind of research or polling data about the relative contentedness with their lives as compared to how men are reporting that. And apparently it was better in the 70s than like around today.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, this is what the data is showing over and over again. In 2009, there was a really significant study that I do lay out in the book a little bit that definitely show that women are decreasing in happiness and their reported happiness. But you also see in things like depression levels, suicide numbers, substance abuse, divorce rates, all of those kinds of things are indicators that women are not happier. And I think by and large, it's because feminism has sold us this ideal of the independent woman and that we can sort of live on our own and be incredibly happy and flourish that way, when in fact the female heart is made for relationships. That's really where most of us find our greatest happiness. So if you take all those relationships away from women, it's not going to make them happy. We're not going to be happy if we're just left by ourselves, especially as we grow older and we realize we've gone to the point where it's, you can't go back and have those children because your fertility is over and, you know, all of that. So I think it's pretty predictable when you start forcing women to behave like men that they're not going to be happy as women in that mold.
Well, the book is The End of Woman: How Smashing the Patriarchy Has Destroyed Us. I highly recommend it. I'll have the link in the description also on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/2388. Carrie Gress, I hope you'll come back on to talk further about this and hope people will read your book. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much. I'd love to come back.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.